Counter to zero. Chapter 17. The Squirrel Wood. The plane had gone to ground near the sound of running water. Turner could hear it, turning in the G-web in his fever asleep. Water Down Stone, one of the oldest songs. The plane was smart, smart as any dog, with hardwired instincts of concealment. He felt it sway on its landing gear, somewhere in the sick night, and creep forward, branches brushing and scraping against the dark canopy. The plane crept into deep green shadow and sank down on its knees, its airframe whining and creaking as it flattened itself, belly down into loam and granite, like a manta ray into sand. The mimetic polycarbon coating, its wings and fuselage, mottled and darkened, taking on the colors and patterns of moon-dappled stone and forest soil. Finally, it was silent, and the only sound was the sound of water over a creek bed. He came awake like a machine, eyes opening, vision plugged in, empty, remembering the red flash of Lynch's death out beyond the fixed sights of the Smith & Wesson. The arc of the canopy above him was laced with mimetic approximations of leaves and branches. Pale dawn and the sound of running water. He was still wearing Oki's blue work shirt. It smelled of sour sweat now, and he'd ripped the sleeves out the day before. The gun lay between his legs, pointing at the jet's black joystick. The G-web was a limp tangle around his hips and shoulders. He twisted around and saw the girl. Oval face and a brown, dried trickle of blood beneath the nostril. She was still out, sweating, her lips slightly parted, like a doll's.
Where are we?
We are 50 meters south-southeast of the landing coordinates you provided, the plane said. You were unconscious again. I opted for concealment. He reached back and removed the interface plug from his socket, breaking his link with the plane. He gazed dully around the cockpit until he found the manual controls for the canopy. It sighed up on servos, the lacework of polycarbon leaves shifting as it moved. He got his leg over the side, looked down at his hand flat against the fuselage at the edge of the cockpit. Polycarbon reproduced the gray tones of a nearby boulder. As he watched, it began to paint a hand-sized patch the color of his palm. He pulled his other leg over, the gun forgotten on the seat, and slid down into earth and long sweet grass. Then he slept again, his forehead against the grass, and dreamed of running water. When he woke, he was crawling forward on his hands and knees, through low branches heavy with dew. Finally, he reached a clearing and pitched forward, rolling over, his arms spread in what felt like surrender. High above him, something small and gray launched itself from one branch, caught another, swung there for an instant, then scrambled away out of his sight. Lie still, he heard a voice telling him, years away. Just lay out and relax, and pretty soon they'll forget you. Forget you in the gray and the dawn and the dew. They're out to feed. Feed and play. And their brains can't hold two messages. Not for long. He lay there on his back beside his brother, the nylon-stocked Winchester across his chest, breathing the smell of new brass and gun oil, the smell of their campfire still in his hair. And his brother was always right about the squirrels. They came. They forgot the clear glyph of death spelled out below them in patched denim and blue steel. They came, racing along limbs, pausing to sniff the morning, and Turner's 22 cracked, a limp gray body tumbling down. The other scattered, vanishing, and Turner passed the gun to his brother. Again they waited. Waited for the squirrels to forget them.
You're like me,
Turner said to the squirrels, bobbing up out of his dream. One of them sat up suddenly on a fat limb and looked directly at him.
I always come back.
The squirrel hopped away.
I was coming back when I ran from the Dutchman. I was coming back when I flew to Mexico. I was coming back when I killed Lynch.
He lay there for a long time, watching the squirrels, while the woods woke and the morning warmed around him. A crow swept in, banking, breaking with feathers, it spread like black mechanical fingers, checking to see if he were dead. Turner grinned up at the crow as it flapped away.
Not yet.
He crawled back in under the overhanging branches and found her sitting up in the cockpit. She wore a baggy white t-shirt slashed diagonally with the Mas Neotech logo. There were lozenges of fresh red blood across the front of the shirt. Her nose was bleeding again. Bright blue eyes, dazed and disoriented, in sockets bruised yellow-black like exotic makeup. Young, he saw. Very young.
You're Mitchell's daughter,
he said, dragging the name up from the Biosoft dossier.
Angela.
Angie,
she said automatically.
Who are you? I'm bleeding.
She held out a bloody carnation of wadded tissue.
Turner, I was expecting your father.
Remembering the gun now, her other hand out of sight, below the edge of the cockpit.
Do you know where he is?
In the mesa.
He thought he could talk with them, explain it.
Because they need him.
With who?
He took a step forward.
Mas. The board.
They can't afford to hurt him, can they?
Why would they?
Another step. She dabbed at her nose with the red tissue.
Because he sent me out. Because he knew they were going to hurt me. Kill me, maybe. Because of the dreams.
The dreams?
Do you think they'll hurt him?
No, they wouldn't do that.
I'm going to climb up there now. Okay?
She nodded. He had to run his hands over the side of the fuselage to find the shallow, recessed handholds. The mimetic coating showed him leaf and lichen, twigs. And then he was up, beside her, and he saw the gun beside her sneakered foot.
But wasn't he coming himself? I was expecting him, your father.
No. We never planned that. We only had the one plane, didn't he tell you?
She started to shake.
Didn't he tell you anything?
Enough, he said, putting his hand on her shoulder. He told us enough. It'll be all right.
He swung his legs over, bent, moved the Smith & Wesson away from her foot, and found the interface cable. His hand still on her, he raised it, snapped it into place behind his ear.
Give me the procedures for erasing anything you stored in the past 48 hours, he said. I want to dump that course for Mexico City. Your flight from the coast, anything.
There was no plan logged for Mexico City. The voice said, direct neural input on audio. Turner stared at the girl, rubbed his jaw.
Where were we going?
Bogota.
And the jet reeled out coordinates for the landing they hadn't made.
She blinked at him, her lids bruised dark as the surrounding skin.
Who are you talking to?
The plane.
Did Mitchell tell you where he thought you'd be going?
Japan.
Know anyone in Bogota? Where's your mother?
No. Berlin, I think. I don't really know her.
He wiped the plane's banks, dumping Conroy's programming, what there was of it. The approach from California, identification data for the site, a flight plan that would have taken them to a strip within 300 kilometers of Bogota's urban core. Someone would find the jet eventually. He thought about the MAS orbital recon system and wondered if the stealth and evasion programs he'd ordered the plane to run had done any real good. He could offer the jet to Rudy for salvage, but he doubted Rudy would want to be involved. For that matter, simply showing up at the farm with Mitchell's daughter in tow dragged Rudy in right up to his neck. But there was nowhere else to go. Not for the things he needed now. It was a 4-hour walk, along half-remembered trails and down a weed-grown, winding stretch of two-lane blacktop. The trees were different, it seemed to him. And then he remembered how much they would have grown over the years since he'd been back. At regular intervals, they passed the stumps of wooden poles that had once supported telephone wires, overgrown now with bramble and honeysuckle, the wires pulled down for fuel. Bees grazed in flowering grass at the roadside.
Is there food where we're going?
The girl asked, the soles of her white sneakers scuffing the weathered blacktop.
Sure, Turner said.
All you want.
What I want right now is water.
She swiped a lank strand of brown hair back from a tanned cheek. He'd noticed she was developing a limp, and she'd started to wince each time she put her right foot down.
What's wrong with your leg?
Ankle. Something I think when I decked the light.
She grimaced, kept walking.
We'll rest.
No, I want to get there, get anywhere.
Rest, he said, taking her hand, leading her to the edge of the road.
She made a face but sat down beside him. Her right leg stretched carefully in front of her.
That's a big gun, she said.
It was hot now, too hot for the parka. He'd put the shoulder rig on bareback, with the sleeveless work shirt over it, tails out and flapping.
Why's the barrel look like that? Like a cobra's head underneath?
That's a sighting device for night fights.
He leaned forward to examine her ankle. It was swelling quickly now.
I don't know how much longer you'll want to walk on that, he said.
You get into a lot of fights at night? With guns?
No.
I don't think I understand what it is that you do.
He looked up at her. I don't always understand that myself. Not lately. I was expecting your father. He wanted to change companies, work for somebody else. The people he wanted to work for hired me and some other people to make sure he got out of his old contract.
But there wasn't any way out of that contract, she said. Not legally.
That's right.
Undoing the knot, unlacing the sneaker.
Not legally.
Oh. So that's what you do for a living?
Yes.
Sneaker off now. She wore no sock, the ankle swelling badly.
This is a sprain.
What about the other people, then? You had more people back there in that ruin. Somebody was shooting and those flares.
Hard to say who was shooting, he said. But the flares weren't ours. Maybe Moss security team following you out. Did you think you got out clean?
I did what Chris told me, she said. Chris, that's my father.
I know. I think I'm going to have to carry you the rest of the way.
But what about your friends?
What friends?
Back there in Arizona.
Right. Well. And he wiped sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand. Can't say. Don't really know. Seeing the white-out sky, flare of energy brighter than the sun, but no pulse of electromagnetics, the plane had said. The first of Rudy's augmented dogs picked them up 15 minutes after they started out again. Angie riding Turner's back, arms around his shoulders, skinny thighs under his armpits, his fingers locked in front of his sternum in a double fist. She smelled like a kid from the upline burbs, some vaguely herbal hint of soap or shampoo. Thinking that, he thought about what he must smell like to her. Rudy had a shower.
Oh, shit, what's that?
Stiffening on his back, pointing. A lean gray hound regarded them from a high clay bank at a turning in the road. Its narrow head sheathed and blindered in a black hood, studded with sensors. It panted, tongue lolling, and slowly swung its head from side to side.
It's okay, Turner said. Watchdog. Belongs to my friend.
The house had grown, sprouting wings and workshops, but Rudy had never painted the peeling clapboard of the original structure. Rudy had thrown up a taut square of chain link since Turner's time, fencing away his collection of vehicles, but the gate was open when they arrived, the hinges lost in morning glory and rust. The real defenses, Turner knew, were elsewhere. Four of the augmented hounds trotted after him as he trudged up the gravel drive. Angie's head limp on his shoulder, her arms still locked around him. Rudy was waiting on the front porch in old white shorts and a navy t-shirt, its single pocket displaying at least 9 pens of one kind or another. He looked at them and raised a green can of Dutch beer in greeting. Behind him, a blonde in a faded khaki shirt stepped out of the kitchen, a chrome spatula in her hand. Her hair was clipped short, swept up and back in a cut that made Turner think of the Korean medic in Hosaka's pod, of the pod burning, of Weber, of the white sky. He swayed there, in Rudy's gravel driveway, legs wide to support the girl, his bare chest streaked with sweat, with dust from the mall in Arizona, and looked at Rudy and the blonde.
"We got some breakfast for you," Rudy said. "When you came up on the dog screens, we figured you'd be hungry."
His tone was carefully noncommittal. The girl groaned.
"That's good," Turner said. "She's got a bum ankle, Rudy. We better look at that. Some other things I have to talk to you about, too."
"Little young for you, I'd say,"
Rudy said and took another swig of his beer.
"Fuck off, Rudy," the woman beside him said. "Can't you see she's hurt?"
"Bring her in this way,"
she said to Turner, and was gone back through the kitchen door.
"You look different," Rudy said, peering at him, and Turner saw that he was drunk. "The same, but different."
"It's been a while,"
Turner said, starting for the wooden steps.
"You get a face job or something?"
"Reconstruction,"
They had to build it back from records. He climbed the steps, his lower back stabbed through with pain at every move.
It's not bad, Rudy said. I almost didn't notice.
He belched. He was shorter than Turner and going to fat, but they had the same brown hair, very similar features. Turner paused on the stair when their eyes were level. You still do a little bit of everything, Rudy. I need this kid scanned. I need a few other things, too.
Well, his brother said, we'll see what we can do. We heard something last night. Maybe a sonic boom. Anything to do with you?
Yeah. There's a jet up by the squirrel wood, but it's pretty well out of sight.
Rudy sighed. Jesus. Well, bring her in.
Rudy's years in the house had stripped it of most of the things that Turner might have remembered, and something in him was obscurely grateful for that. He watched the blonde crack eggs into a steel bowl. Dark yellow free-range yolks. Rudy kept his own chickens.
I'm Sally, she said, whisking the eggs around with a fork.
Turner.
That's all he ever calls you either, she said. He never has talked about you much.
We haven't kept all that much in touch. Maybe I should go up now and help him.
You sit. Your little girl's okay with Rudy. He's got a good touch.
Even when he's pissed?
Half pissed. Well, he's not going to operate just to derm her and tape that ankle.
She crushed dry tortilla chips into a black pan over sizzling butter and poured the eggs on top.
What happened to your eyes, Turner? You and her?
She stirred the mixture with the chrome spatula, slopping in salsa from a plastic tub. G-force had to take off quick.
That how she hurt her ankle?
Maybe, don't know.
People after you now? After her?
Busy taking plates from the cabinet above the sink, the cheap brown laminate of the cabinet doors triggering a sudden rush of nostalgia in Turner, seeing her tanned wrists as his mother's. Probably, he said. I don't know what's involved, not yet.
Eat some of this.
Transferring the mixture to a white plate, rummaging for a fork.
Rudy's scared of the kind of people you might get after you.
Taking the plate, the fork, steam rising from the eggs. So am I.
Got some clothes,
Sally said over the sound of the shower. Friend of Rudy's left him here.
Ought to fit you.
The shower was gravity-operated, rainwater from a roof tank, a fat white filtration unit strapped into the pipe above the spray head. Turner stuck his head out between the cloudy sheets of plastic and blinked at her.
Thanks.
Girl's unconscious, she said. Rudy thinks it's shock, exhaustion. He says her crits are high, so he might as well run his scan now.
She left the room then, taking Turner's fatigues and Oki's shirt with her.
What is she?
Rudy, extending a crumpled scroll of silvery printout. I don't know how to read that. Turner said, looking around the white room looking for Angie. Where is she?
Sleeping. Sally's watching her.
Rudy turned and walked back the length of the room, and Turner remembered it had been the living room once. Rudy began to shut his consoles down, the tiny pilot lights blinking out one by one.
I don't know, man. I just don't know. What is it, some kind of cancer?
Turner followed him down the room, past a work table, where a micro-manipulator waited beneath its dust cover. Past the dusty rectangular eyes of a bank of aged monitors, one of them with a shattered screen.
"It's all through her head," Rudy said. "Like long chains of it. It doesn't look like anything I've ever seen, ever. Nothing."
"How much do you know about biochips, Rudy?" Rudy grunted. He seemed very sober now, but tense, agitated. He kept running his hands back through his hair.
"That's what I thought. It's some kind of... not an implant. Graft."
"What's it for?"
"For? Christ, who the fuck knows? Who did it to her? Somebody you work for?"
"Her father, I think."
"Jesus."
Rudy wiped his hand across his mouth.
"It shadows like tumor on the scans, but her crits are high enough, normal. What's she like ordinarily?"
"Don't know. A kid?" He shrugged.
"Fucking hell," Rudy said. "I'm amazed she can walk."
He opened a little lab freezer and came out with a frosted bottle of Moskovskaya.
"Want it out of the bottle?" he asked.
"Maybe later." Rudy sighed, looked at the bottle, then returned it to the fridge.
"So what do you want? Anything as weird as what's in that little girl's head, somebody's going to be after it soon, if they aren't already."
"They are," Turner said. "I don't know if they know she's here."
"Yet."
Rudy wiped his palms on his grubby white shorts.
"But they probably will, right?"
Turner nodded.
"Where are you going to go, then?"
"The sprawl."
"Why?"
"Because I've got money there. I've got credit lines in 4 different names, no way to link them back to me. Because I've got a lot of other connections I may be able to use. And because it's always cover, the sprawl. So damned much of it, you know?"
"Okay,"
Rudy said.
"When?"
"You that worried about it? You want us right out?"
"No, I mean, I don't know. It's all pretty interesting, what's in your girlfriend's head. I've got a friend in Atlanta. Could rent me a function analyzer. Brain map. 1-to-1. Put that on her, I might start to figure out what that thing is. Might be worth something."
"Sure. If you knew where to sell it."
"Aren't you curious? I mean, what the hell is she? You pull her out of some military lab?"
Rudy opened the white freezer door again, took out the bottle of vodka, opened it, and took a swallow. Turner took the bottle and tilted it, letting the icy fluid splash against his teeth. He swallowed, shuddered.
"It's corporate. Big. I was supposed to get her father out, but he sent her instead. Then somebody took the whole side out. Looked like a baby nuke. We just made it this far."
He handed Rudy the bottle. "Stay straight from you, Rudy. You get scared. You drink too much." Rudy was staring at him, ignoring the bottle.
"Arizona," he said. "It was on the news. Mexico's still kicking about it, but it wasn't a nuke. They've had crews out there all over it, no nuke."
"What was it?"
"They think it was a railgun. They think somebody put up a hypervelocity gun in a cargo blimp and blew hell out of some derelict mall out there in the boonies. They know there was a blimp near there, and so far nobody's found it. You can rig a railgun to blow itself to plasma when it discharges. The projectile could have been damn near anything at those velocities. About 150 kilos of ice would do the trick.
He took the bottle, capped it, and put it down on the counter beside him.
All that land around there, it belongs to Moss. Moss Biolabs, doesn't it? They've been on the news, Moss. Cooperating fully with various authorities. You bet. So that tells us where you got your little honey from, I guess.
Sure. But it doesn't tell me who used the railgun. Or why. Rudy shrugged.
You'd better come see this,
Sally said from the door. Much later, Turner sat with Sally on the front porch. The girl had lapsed finally into something Rudy's EEG called sleep. Rudy was back in one of his workshops, probably with his bottle of vodka. There were fireflies around the honeysuckle vines beside the chain-link gate. Turner found that if he half-closed his eyes, from a seat on the wooden porch swing, he could almost see an apple tree that was no longer there. The tree that had once supported a length of silvery gray hemp rope and an ancient automobile tire. There were fireflies then as well, and Rudy's heels thumping a bare, hard skid of earth as he pumped himself out on the swing's arc, legs kicking, and Turner lay on his back in the grass watching the stars. Tongues, Sally said, Rudy's woman from the creaking rattan chair. Her cigarette, a red eye in the dark. Talking in the tongues.
What's that?
What your kid was doing upstairs. You know any French?
No, not much. Not without a lexicon.
Some of it sounded French to me.
The red amber was a short slash for an instant when she tapped ash.
When I was little, my old man took me one time to the stadium, and I saw the testifying and the speaking in tongues. It scared me. I think it scared me more today when she started.
Rudy taped the end of it, didn't he?
Yeah. You know, Rudy hasn't been doing too good. That's mainly why I moved back in here. I told him I wasn't staying unless he straightened himself out. But then it got real bad, so about 2 weeks ago I moved back in. I was about ready to go when you showed up.
The coal of the cigarette arced out over the railing and fell on the gravel that covered the yard.
Drinking?
That and the stuff he cooks for himself in the lab. You know, that man knows a little bit of damn near everything. He's still got a lot of friends around the county. I've heard him tell stories about when you and him were kids. Before you left.
He should have left, too. He said.
He hates the city. She said. Says it all comes in online anyway. So why do you need to go there?
I went because there was nothing happening here. Rudy could always find something to do. Still can by the look of it.
You should have stayed in touch. He wanted you here when your mother was dying.
I was in Berlin, couldn't leave what I was doing.
I guess not. I wasn't here then either. I came later. That was a good summer. Rudy just pulled me out of the sleaze-ass club in Memphis. Came in there with a bunch of country boys one night, and next day I was back here. Didn't really know why. Except he was nice to me those days. And funny. And he gave my head a chance to slow down. He taught me to cook.
She laughed.
I liked that. Except I was scared of those goddamn chickens out back.
She stood up then and stretched, the old chair creaking, and he was aware of the length of her tanned legs, the smell and summer heat of her close to his face. She put her hands on his shoulders. His eyes were level with the band of brown belly where her shorts rode low, her navel a soft shadow, and remembering Allison in the white hollow room, he wanted to press his face there, taste it all. He thought she swayed slightly, but he wasn't sure.
Turner, she said. Sometimes being here with him, it's like being here alone.
So he stood. Rattle of the old swing chain where the eye bolts were screwed deep in the tongue and groove of the porch roof. Bolts his father might have turned 40 years before. And kissed her mouth as it opened. Cut loose in time by talk and the fireflies and the subliminal triggers of memory. So that it seemed to him, as he ran his palms up the warmth of her bare back beneath the white t-shirt, that the people in his life weren't beads strung on a wire of sequins, but clustered like quanta. So that he knew her as well as he'd known Rudy, or Allison, or Conroy. As well as he knew the girl who was Mitchell's daughter.
Hey,
she whispered, working her mouth free.
You come upstairs now.
Chapter 18. Names of the Dead. Alan phoned at 5 and verified the availability of the amount he required, fighting to control the sickness she felt at his greed. She copied the address carefully on the back of a card she'd taken from Picard's desk in the Roberts Gallery. Andrea returned from work 10 minutes later, and Marley was glad that her friend hadn't been there for Alan's call. She watched Andrea prop up the kitchen window with a frayed, blue-backed copy of the second volume of the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, 6th edition. Andrea had wedged a kind of plywood shelf there, on the stone ledge, wide enough to support the little hibachi she kept beneath the sink. Now she was arranging the black squares of charcoal neatly on the grate.
"I had a talk about your employer today," she said,
placing the hibachi on the plywood and igniting the greenish fire starter paste with the spark gun from the stove.
"Our academic was in from Nice. He's baffled as to why I choose Josef Virik as my focus of interest, but he's also a horny old goat, so he was more than glad to talk."
Marley stood beside her, watching the nearly invisible flames lick around the coals.
"He kept dragging the Tessier ash pools into it,"
Andrea continued.
"And Hughes. Hughes was mid to late 20th century, an American. He's in the book as well as a sort of proto-Virik. I hadn't known that Tessier Ashpool had started to disintegrate."
She went back to the counter and unwrapped 6 large tiger prawns.
"They're Franco-Australian? I remember a documentary, I think. They own one of the big spas? Freeside. It's been sold now, my professor tells me. It seems that one of old Ashpool's daughters somehow managed to gain personal control of the entire business entity, became increasingly eccentric, and the clan's interests went to hell. This over the past 7 years. I don't see what it has to do with Virik," Marley said,
watching Andrea skewer each prawn on a long needle of bamboo.
"Your guess is as good as mine. My professor maintains that both Virik and the Tessier Ashpools are fascinating anachronisms, and that things can be learned about corporate evolution by watching them. He's convinced enough of our senior editors, at any rate. But what did he say about Virik? That Virik's madness would take a different form." "Madness?" "Actually, he avoided calling it that. But Hughes was mad as birds, apparently, and old Ashpool as well, and his daughter totally bizarre. He said that Virik would be forced by evolutionary pressures to make some sort of jump. Jump was his word.
Evolutionary pressures.
Yes,
Andrea said, carrying the skewered prawns to the hibachi.
He talks about corporations as though they were animals of some kind.
After dinner, they went out walking. Marley found herself straining at times to sense the imagined mechanism of Virik's surveillance, but Andrea filled the evening with her usual warmth and common sense, and Marley was grateful to walk through a city where things were simply themselves. In Virik's world, what could be simple? She remembered the brass knob in the Galerie du Perret, how it had squirmed so indescribably in her fingers as it drew her into Virik's model of the Parque Güell.
Was he always there, she wondered, in Gaudi's park, in an afternoon that never ended?
Señor is wealthy. Señor enjoys any number of means of manifestation.
She shivered in the warm evening air, moved closer to Andrea. The sinister thing about a SimStim construct, really, was that it carried the suggestion that any environment might be unreal. That the windows of the shop fronts she passed now with Andrea might be figments. Mirrors, someone had once said, were in some way essentially unwholesome. Constructs were more so, she decided. Andrea paused at a kiosk to buy her English cigarettes and the new L. Marley waited on the pavement, the pedestrian traffic parting automatically for her, faces sliding past, students and businessmen and tourists. Some of them, she assumed, were part of Virik's machine, wired into Paco.
Paco,
with his brown eyes, his easy way, his seriousness, muscles moving beneath his broadcloth shirt.
Paco, who had worked for Señor all his life.
What's wrong?
You look as though you've just swallowed something.
Andrea, stripping the cellophane from her 20 silk cut.
No, Marley said and shivered. But it occurs to me that I very nearly did.
And walking home, in spite of Andrea's conversation, her warmth, the shop windows had become boxes, each one, constructions, like the works of Joseph Cornell, or the mysterious boxmaker Virik sought. The books and furs and Italian cottons arranged to suggest geometries of nameless longing. And waking once again, face smudged into Andrea's couch, the red quilt humped around her shoulders, smelling coffee, while Andrea hummed some Tokyo pop song to herself in the next room, dressing, in a gray morning of Paris rain.
No, she told Paco. I'll go myself, I prefer it.
That is a great deal of money.
He looked down at the Italian bag on the cafe table between them.
It's dangerous, you understand?
There's no one to know I'm carrying it, is there? Only Alan.
Alan and your friends.
And I didn't say I'd go alone, only that I don't feel like company.
Is something wrong?
The serious deep lines at the corners of his mouth.
You are upset.
I only mean that I wish to be by myself. You and the others, whoever they are welcome to follow. To follow and observe. If you should lose me, which I think unlikely, I'm sure you have the address.
That is true, he said. But for you to carry several million new yen alone through Paris?
He shrugged.
And if I were to lose it, would Señor register the loss? Or would there be another bag? Another 4 million?
She reached for the shoulder strap and stood.
There would be another bag, certainly. Although it requires some effort on our part to assemble that amount of cash. And no, Señor would not register its loss in the sense you mean. But I would be disciplined, even for the pointless loss of a lesser sum. The very rich have the common characteristic of taking care with their money, you will find.
Nonetheless, I go by myself. Not alone, but leave me with my thoughts.
Your intuition.
Yes.
If they followed, and she was sure they did, they were invisible as ever. For that matter, it seemed most likely that they would leave Alan unobserved. Certainly the address he had given her that morning would already be a focus of their attention, whether he were there or not. She felt a new strength today. She had stood up to Paco. It had had something to do with her abrupt suspicion the night before that Paco might be there in part for her, with his humor and his manliness and his endearing ignorance of art. She remembered Vidic saying that they knew more about her life than she herself did. What easier way, then, for them to pencil in those last few blanks in the grid that was Marley Khrushchova? Paco Esteves, a perfect stranger. Too perfect. She smiled at herself in a wall of blue mirror as the escalator carried her down into the metro, pleased with the cut of her dark hair and the stylishly austere titanium frames of the black Porsche glasses she'd bought that morning. Good lips, she thought. Really not bad lips at all. And a thin boy in a white shirt and dark leather jacket smiled at her from the up escalator, a huge black portfolio case beneath his arm. I am in Paris, she thought. For the first time in a very long time, that alone seemed reason to smile. And today, I will give my disgusting fool of a former lover 4 million new yen, and he will give me something in return. A name, or an address, perhaps a phone number. She bought a first-class ticket. The car would be less crowded, and she could pass the time guessing which of her fellow passengers belonged to Virek. The address Alan had given her in a grim northern suburb was one of 20 concrete towers rising from a plain of the same material. Speculative real estate from the middle of the previous century. The rain was falling steadily now, but she felt as though she was somehow in collusion with it. It lent the day something conspiratorial and beaded on the chic rubber bag stuffed with Alan's fortune. How queer to stroll through this hideous landscape with millions beneath her arm, on her way to reward her utterly faithless former lover with these bales of new yen. There was no answer when she buzzed the apartment's numbered speaker button. Beyond smudged sheet glass, a darkened foyer, entirely bare. The sort of place where you turned the lights on as you entered. They turned themselves off again, automatically, invariably before your elevator had arrived, leaving you to wait there in the smell of disinfectant and tired air. She buzzed again. Alan? Nothing. She tried the door. It wasn't locked. There was no one in the foyer. The dead eye of a derelict video camera regarded her through a film of dust. The afternoon's watery light seeped in from the concrete plain behind her. Boot heels clicking on brown tile. She crossed to the bank of elevators and pressed button 22. There was a hollow thump, a metallic groan, and one of the elevators began to descend. The plastic indicators above the doors remained unlit.
The car arrived with a sigh and a high-pitched fading whine. Cher Alan, you have come down in the world. This place is the shits, truly. As the door slid open on the darkness of the car, she fumbled beneath the Italian bag for the flap of her Brussels purse. She found the flat little green tin flashlight she'd carried since her first walk in Paris, with the lion-headed Pile Wonder trademark embossed on its front, and pulled it out. In the elevators of Paris, you could step into many things. The arms of a mugger, a steaming pile of fresh dog shit. And the weak beam picking out the silver cables, oiled and shining, swaying gently in the vacant shaft, the toe of her right boot already centimeters past the scuffed steel edge of the tile she stood on. Her hand automatically jerking the beam down in terror, down to the dusty-littered roof of the car, two levels below. She took in an extraordinary amount of detail in the seconds her flash wavered on the elevator. She thought of a tiny submarine diving the cliffs of some deep seamount, the frail beam wavering on a patch of silt undisturbed for centuries. The soft bed of ancient furry soot, a dried gray thing that was a used condom. The bright reflected eyes of crumpled bits of tinfoil. The frail gray barrel and white plunger of a diabetic syringe. She held the edge of the door so tightly that her knuckle joints ached. Very slowly, she shifted her weight backward, away from the pit. Another step, and she clicked off her light. "Damn you," she said. "Oh, Jesus." She found the door to the stairwell. Clicking the little flash back on, she began to climb. 8 floors up, the numbness began to fade, and she was shaking, tears ruining her makeup. Rapping on the door again, it was pressboard, laminated with a ghastly imitation of rosewood, the lithographed grain just visible in the light from the long corridor's single strip of biofluorescence. "Damn you." "Alan? Alan!" The myopic fisheye of the door's little spyglass looking through her, blank and vacant. The corridor held a horrible smell, embalmed cooking odors trapped in synthetic carpeting. Trying the door, knob turning, the cheap brass greasy and cold, and the bag of money suddenly heavy, the strap cutting into her shoulder. The door opening easily. A short stretch of orange carpet flecked with irregular rectangles of salmon pink. Decades of dirt ground into it in a clearly defined track by thousands of tenants and their visitors. "Alan?" The smell of black French cigarettes, almost comforting. And finding him there in that same watery light, silver light, the other tower blocks featureless, beyond a rectangle of window, against pale, rainy sky, where he lay curled like a child on the hideous orange carpet, his spine a question mark beneath the taut back of his bottle-green velour jacket, his left hand spread above his ear, white fingers, faintest bluish tint at the base of his nails. Kneeling, she touched his neck. New. Beyond the window, all the rain sliding down forever. Cradling his head, legs open, holding him, rocking, swaying, the dumb, sad animal keening filling the bare rectangle of the room. And after a time, becoming aware of the sharp thing under her palm, the neat stainless end of a length of very fine, very rigid wire that protruded from his ear and between the spread, cool fingers. Ugly. Ugly, that was no way to die. It got her up. Anger. Her hands like claws. To survey the silent room where he had died. There was no sense of him there. Nothing, only his ragged attaché. Opening that, she found two spiral notebooks, their pages new and clean, an unread but very fashionable novel, a box of wooden matches, and a half-empty blue packet of Gauloise. The leather-bound agenda from Brown's was gone. She patted his jacket, slid fingers through his pockets, but it was gone. No, she thought, you wouldn't have written it there, would you? But you could never remember a number or an address, could you? She looked around the room again, a weird calm overtaking her. You had to write things down, but you were secretive. And you didn't trust my little book from Brown's, no. You'd meet a girl in some cafe and write her number in a matchbook or on the back of some scrap and forget it, so that I found it weeks later, straightening up your things. She went into the tiny bedroom. There was a bright red folding chair and a slab of cheap yellow foam that served as a bed. The foam was marked with a brown butterfly of menstrual blood. She lifted it, but there was nothing there. You'd have been scared, she said, her voice shaking with a fury she didn't try to understand, her hands cold, colder than Alan's as she ran them down the red wallpaper, striped with gold, seeking some loose seam, a hiding place. You poor stupid shit. Poor stupid dead shit. Nothing. Back into the living room and amazed, somehow, that he hadn't moved, expecting him to jump up, hello, waving a few centimeters of trick wire. She removed his shoes. They needed resoling, new heels. She looked inside, felt the lining. Nothing. Don't do this to me. And back into the bedroom, the narrow closet, brushing aside a clatter of cheap white plastic hangers, a limp shroud of dry cleaner's plastic. Dragging the stained bed slab over and standing on it, her heels sinking to the foam to slide her hands the length of a pressboard shelf and find, in the far corner, a hard little fold of paper, rectangular and blue. Opening it, noticing how the nails she'd done so carefully were chipped, and finding the number he'd written there in green felt pen. It was an empty Gauloise packet. There was a knock at the door. And then Paco's voice.
Marley! Hello? What has happened?
She thrust the number into the waistband of her jeans and turned to meet his calm, serious eyes. It's Alan, she said. He's dead. Chapter 19. Hypermart. He saw Lucas for the last time in front of a big old department store on Madison Avenue. That was how he remembered him after that. A big black man in a sharp black suit, about to step into his long black car, one black, softly polished shoe already on the lush carpet of Ahmed's interior, the other still on the crumbling concrete of the curb. Jackie stood beside Bobby, her face shadowed by the wide brim of her gold-hung fedora. An orange silk headscarf knotted at the back of her neck.
You take care of our young friend now,
Lucas said, pointing the knob of his cane at her.
He's not without his enemies, our count.
Who is? Jackie asked. I'll take care of myself, Bobby said, resenting the idea of Jackie being seen as more capable, yet at the same time knowing that she almost certainly was.
You do that,
Lucas said, the knob swinging, lined up now with Bobby's eyes.
Sprawl Town's a twisty place, my man. Things are seldom what they seem.
To illustrate his point,
He did something to the cane that caused the long brass splines below the ball to open smoothly for an instant. Silently, extended like the ribs of an umbrella, each one glinting sharp as a razor, pointed like needles. Then they were gone, and Ahmed's wide door swung shut with an armor-plated thud.